Earshot. Earshot.
Hi, I'm Sherry DeLeese. I teach mindfulness. I'm with Ron Purser outside his home in Pacifica, California, a laid-back coastal city just down the road from Silicon Valley. We're waiting for an Uber.
Unfortunately, your driver had to cancel. See, that's what I don't like about Uber.
Did you see the cars, where they were?
3 minutes.
It says looking for another rider, though.
Ron's a fierce critic of how the Buddhist meditation practice of mindfulness, designed in ancient times to free the mind from greed, hatred, and delusion, is rolling out in the West as an exponentially expanding franchise some call mech mindfulness. We've been talking so long, I'm late for my plane and seriously need my driver to show up.
So this Uber app, I mean, here's a classic example of Silicon Valley or American innovation, you know, coming up with a new product that meets people's needs. I mean, is there any parallels we can draw here with what's been happening with Buddhism as it's traveled to the West?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I think what we really have to appreciate is that since we don't have the monastic communities as we did in the East, and there was this reciprocal exchange between lay people and the monastics, we don't have that here. So basically, we have entrepreneurs. We have entrepreneurs who are self-fashioned themselves as mindfulness teachers, which then can offer their products and make millions of dollars.
What I'm noticing about mindfulness teaching, mindfulness apps, is that the promises get bigger and bigger and the time that
shorter
you need to practice
shorter.
Shorter and shorter. So it's trying to adjust to these lives that we're living. And in one sense, why shouldn't it? That just makes sense.
But we're not really asking the deeper question of what is the good life and how do we live it? Instead, we're given tools and techniques to live the lives that we're putting up with.
Speaking of which, where's my Uber? I'm worried I'm going to miss my plane.
Ron's Beyond Mech Mindfulness piece for the Huffington Post, co-authored with Buddhist teacher David Loy, went seriously viral. And debate about the uses of mindfulness has raged ever since. If only the Buddha had been blessed with social media.
There you go.
How you doing, man?
Hello, I'm good. The Uber app told you the wrong place. Does it do that sometimes? Make a mistake?
Yeah.
Oh. That must make it difficult.
Yeah. And how long till Silicon Valley comes up with a mindful car? But more seriously, in a time of rising inequality, chaotic politics, and the ransacking of the planet, could this ancient technology of consciousness help the whole world find its way? Now that's my question. And if it sounds a little overstated, then come with me to a place where mindfulness means more than just developing a competitive edge. The Insight Meditation Society in the small town of Barre, Massachusetts, is one of the Western world's oldest and most respected meditation retreat centers. Students come here to learn Buddhist meditations known as metta, or loving-kindness, and vipassana, or mindfulness. Kamala Masters is a guiding teacher here at IMS, and she's leading me past rooms where students can talk with teachers during silent retreat.
Where we're walking down now is called Guru Alley. Well, it used to be called that back in the day.
What kinds of things do the teacher and student talk about?
We ask them to bring their attention around what's been happening here in retreat, because all the instructions that are given are more focused on what's going on in your moment-to-moment awareness, rather than bringing what's going on in their home life into the interview room, where it becomes more of a counseling, or maybe it can get more into psychological understanding. We're really coming from a Dharma place and what the Buddha taught. Yeah. So let's find a place to sit here where we're both comfortable.
Dharma translates something like cosmic law and order. And while these days Wall Street hedge fund managers meditate to be more productive, concentration is only a small part of what the Buddha taught. I want to talk to Kamala about the practice she learned from great insight meditation masters in Burma and India.
generosity is a practice in itself. In fact, when the Buddha went to give teachings, he would many times start out with generosity when he went to the villagers. And then he would talk about ethics or living in harmony with one another. And then he would teach concentration. And then he would teach the wisdom part of it. And also what you said about it's totally up to the one who is receiving the Dharma what they can give. Like, there are sometimes people can't give anything of their material resources, but maybe they come to the monastery to sweep or to clean or to cook the rice. The other important thing to point out is that the Dharma is so precious, you know, that no amount can be set to it.
And I remember the first time that dawned on me, that the teacher who'd put all their loving kindness into the teaching, that person wasn't receiving any money for that. It was the first time that I really understood that this system is completely outside the capitalist system. And I marveled that a teacher who does have to pay rent and buy the groceries just like I do would be committed to live in such a precarious way on the generosity of their students.
Yes, it really makes people's head turn because it's so different from what we live in. And some people go around asking, well, how much are you giving? But it's not about that. It's how much can we give so that we feel generous?
But in this day and age, and the strong growth of Buddhism and mindfulness in the West, is it realistic to hope that people can keep this going?
Oh, of course. I know it's realistic because many people do. And not only do they keep it going, but they reach places of what the Buddha would place the greatest value on in their teaching, and that is really to develop a mind and heart that is completely or almost completely filled with kindness, generosity, and wisdom. And sometimes they have positions in the world that have a lot of influence on a lot of other people, you know, heads of companies, and we see a lot of good results, fantastic results.
If mindfulness has been an explosion in the West, this is where the Big Bang happened. Only this explosion had a very quiet beginning.
It was just in the culture, a tremendous interest. So it's as if we caught the wave. So the combination of this burgeoning interest in Eastern thought and meditation practices, combined with a great accessibility for people to practice, I think that all contributed to the spread.
In 1976, Joseph Goldstein, along with Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield, had recently returned from Southeast Asia, where the three had studied Buddhist meditations known as metta, or loving kindness, and vipassana, or mindfulness meditation. Keen to share these practices in the West, they created this place, the Insight Meditation Society. Since then, IMS has hosted tens of thousands of people doing meditation retreat.
It's quite a rigorous practice, and it's a chance for people to drop into what for many people is, at first, is quite an unusual space, given the speed of our culture and the hyper-connectivity of all our devices, you know, to come to a place that's in silence, where one is practicing mindfulness all day long, this opens up a whole new world of experience. The clearest understanding of it, I think, and the most pragmatic one that comes directly from the teachings of the Buddha, is when the Buddha described enlightenment as the mind being freed of greed and hatred and delusion, which are those three root causes of suffering for ourselves and others. So it's very pragmatic. You know, are we freeing our minds from these forces, or are we simply acting out or living out our habitual tendencies?
One thing that I've found wonderful in sitting retreats with you is your ability to translate terms like greed, hatred, and delusion into ideas that I can work with.
Someone once described these three states of greed, hatred, delusion as pulling in, pushing away, wandering around in circles. You know, how often are we lost in the stories or lost, really enmeshed in very strong emotions where we're not being mindful, we're not being aware of what's happening, we're just caught up in them.
So is it fair to say that the primary project of Vipassana meditation is freedom from these states?
Yeah, exactly. And mindfulness is the methodology for doing that, for accomplishing that.
Could mindfulness be used, in fact, though, in service of greed, hatred, or delusion?
If greed, hatred, delusion is the outcome of a particular practice that we're doing, I would say it's not mindfulness, because within the Buddhist context, mindfulness has a very specific meaning. And it's more than simply being present, and it's more than simply recognizing what's there. It's being present and recognizing and being with experience in a particular way. And that way is to be aware without grasping, without aversion, without forgetfulness. So by definition, mindfulness is wholesome.
I'm in the woods, huge area of woods that lie inside the Insight Meditation Society grounds. Wild woods, but with some well-worn paths between, the forest refuge where people are doing self-retreat. There'll be people in the forest refuge now meditating who might be staying there for a week. They might be staying there for a couple of months. Some stay for as long as a year. For however long they're here, they're in silence, doing walking meditation and sitting meditation and at all times practicing mindfulness. When I was here in the American autumn last year doing a six-week silent retreat, I was able to walk in these woods every day and watch the leaves turn from green into crimson, yellow, orange. I mean, the woods were ablaze as all the leaves gradually changed color. And I was here as every single leaf, it seemed, fell off every single tree over a period of many weeks, until they were mulch under my feet. A beautiful lesson in impermanence, a lesson that's right at the center of Buddhist teaching. So, hello, Stephen.
Hi.
Are we going out for a walk?
Let's go do that.
I think it might drizzle a bit, but I'm sure it's something we can cope with.
Did you really want to leave your door open?
They're pretty much off the beaten track. I don't think there's a great danger of people breaking in and trying to steal people's meditation cushions. But you never know.
So this is where it all started.
To be honest, I think we have to say that it started in Burma. And if we're even more honest, we have to say that it started in the 5th century BC in the northeastern part of India with the Buddha. There's no question about that. But more recently, of course, I think it's legitimate to think of it as having begun here in Western Massachusetts.
The idea that mindfulness could change the world has a long history. The Buddha challenged the caste system, gender disparity, slavery, and abuse of animals. But here at IMS, I've caught up with Stephen Batchelor, author of After Buddhism, to talk about the more immediate forerunner of contemporary mindfulness.
We need to recognize that vipassana, or mindfulness practice, originated as part of the anti-colonial movement in Burma towards the end of the 19th century. Part of the anti-colonial movement had to do with recovering the Burmese's sense of identity as Buddhists, but in such a way that it went deeper than the practice of gilding stupas and things like that, but tapped back into the root practices of the Dharma itself. And so the originators of Vipassana meditation had already divested this practice of its more what we might call superstitious or other elements. And so when people like Joseph Goldstein and others were introduced to these practices, one of the reasons that they were so appealing is because they felt so accessible. So they struck us, these practices, as very compatible with modernity. The Buddhist practices we received from Burma particularly, had already undergone a kind of quite radical house cleaning. And I think what has happened in the West has been in many ways simply a continuation of that process. So once mindfulness was then incorporated into healthcare, then even more stuff got shed, as it were, the Buddhist beliefs and philosophy and so on. And at a certain point, even any kind of suggestion this was Buddhist at all.
And so the story goes. The next milestone in the takeover of the West by mindfulness, its move into healthcare, is another reason why Insight Meditation Society is the mothership.
And it began really because Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is probably the most important figure in the secularization of mindfulness, really got his ideas from doing retreats here, where we are now.
And it is true that I had the sort of full-blown, like, insight that that was what I should do on the planet at IMS, sitting in my room on a retreat. And I also saw that if it were successful at UMass, where I had already been working as a scientist, that it would spread around the world as it has. So a very brief but very intense vision.
I just was reading a Buddhist teacher, his blog, and his memory of a moment when you came to him in an interview and said you'd had this idea that this practice that you were doing there, insight meditation practice, could be used to help people who were suffering pain.
Yeah, yeah. And more generally, even people falling through the cracks of the healthcare system of the hospital, and challenge them to do something for themselves that no one on the planet could do for them. And it would be this practice, appropriately rigorous, but not so rigorous that it would blow everybody out of the water, to actually drop into and befriend and cultivate intimacy with the whole dimension of our being that we call awareness or mindfulness.
And the rest is history. Created just 30 miles down the road from IMS at UMass Medical School, Jon Kabat-Zinn's Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Course, or MBSR, has spread around the world through hospitals, prisons, schools, boardrooms, and even the UK Parliament. These days, do a Google Scholar search for mindfulness-based stress reduction, and you'll get around 80,000 results. So I'm here at the Center for Mindfulness at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and I'm here to meet Judson Brewer. He's the, Director of Research, Center for Mindfulness. I'm just here at his office. So.
Come in.
Oh, hi, Judson.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for changing the time for me.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, I like to joke that this is the house that Jon built, because Jon Kabat-Zinn started the MBSR program here back in the late 1970s. And especially within the medical establishment and within science, this is really the epicenter. We started around the year 2008 or so asking a simple question, which is, you know, what's different in brain activity between experienced meditators and novice meditators? We wanted to see what was commonly activated or deactivated in brains of experienced meditators. We found that there was a decrease in activity in a particular network called the default mode network, which is now thought to involve self-referential processing, and in particular involve things that, you know, when something affects us, when we take something personally. We followed that up with some neurophenomenologic studies where we could link first-person subjective experience to brain activity using real-time neurofeedback. And this is where it started to reveal at least our working hypothesis that one part of this network called the posterior cingulate cortex gets activated when people, if you think about it, people get caught up in their experience when we get in our own way. And this same brain region was quieting down when people were meditating.
What do you mean by getting in their own way?
It's an experiential quality. So if somebody yells at me and says, you know, I think your research is stupid, and I kind of clench up around that or I become defensive, there's this feeling of contraction as compared to when I'm, you know, somebody's being kind or I open the door for somebody or somebody opens the door for me. The opposite of that happens where there's this expansive quality to experience. So it's really an experiential quality of contraction versus expansion. So the contraction is when we get in our own way, whether it's getting caught up in an idea that we think is great or getting caught up in anger when somebody told us that our idea was not so great. That's the getting in our own way, that contraction. And then when we get out of our own way is when it's not about us. It's just getting into the flow of life.
So this is not research that's closeted away in an ivory tower. You're really working on the ground with new technologies and populations.
I'm a clinician. You know, I'm an addiction psychiatrist, and my patients in my clinic suffer all the time. And I really feel it's a big responsibility for us to get what we learn out there into helping our patients as quickly as possible.
From your position as someone who both approaches it as a spiritual discipline and as a researcher, what is it that science can't bring to our understanding of mindfulness?
I don't know anybody that's come up with a good measure for mystery.
Talk to me about how you relate with that bell in your practice.
To me, it's a way of dropping our chatter in our mind and settling down and appreciating the space of sound, allowing the vibrations to open up our sense of space, appreciate the time of the rhythm of sound, and let that enhance our sense of appreciation for the moment.
It becomes a very sweet texture, doesn't it?
Yes.
I often use it too as a reminder about impermanence. I mean, the amount of change that it goes through when you listen closely. I'm back in Pacifica, California, with management professor and Zen teacher Ron Purser. Years ago, Ron's Beyond McMindfulness article went viral. But more recently, he's edited The Handbook of Mindfulness, a collection of essays that forms a blueprint for a more socially engaged mindfulness.
So mindfulness is not just paying attention to the present moment non-judgmentally. It's also using your critical faculties to discern what those sources of stress are and why. What are the causes and conditions that lead to stress? Yes, it's partly internal. It's partly self-generated. But it's not all self-generated. It's also embedded in a social, political, economic context. So I think we have to get beyond this sort of biomedical model of stress. Mindfulness that's not just turning inward to look at one's own emotions and thoughts, but also externally. And that has really been underplayed in the popular mindfulness movement, focused just on the individual's internal states. So mindfulness, if you look at it historically, with Jon Kabat-Zinn's work with mindfulness-based stress reduction, it started in hospitals. So it comes out of a biomedicine context. And now with neuroscience, that emphasizes that even more. It's sort of a brain-based model of disease that's often been referred to as the medicalization of mindfulness.
The Buddha taught mindfulness as a way to understand and end suffering. But in these days, when the global elite at Davos meditate to get the competitive edge, Ron believes corporations have jumped on the mindfulness bandwagon because it shifts the burden onto employees, framing stress as a personal problem.
A lot of mindfulness programs are very individualistic. They don't help people come together to see how they could form bonds of solidarity, calling into question the sources of oppression, calling into questions power inequities and economic inequities.
I guess one of the problems there is Goldman Sachs is very unlikely to pay for such a course to be run in their corporation.
Yeah, that's really the crux of it, is that our consultants who offer mindfulness programs in corporations or mindfulness teachers, are they going to bite the hand that feeds them? And not only are they going to bite the hand that feeds them, but are any corporate executives going to buy such programs that would call into question some of the corporate dysfunctions that are operating or call into question these sort of prerogatives of management? I highly doubt it. So the fact that we've had 2 or 3 years of people calling into question the cheerleading of the mindfulness movement is a good sign. What we're trying to do now is understand how can we be more conscious and critical of how mindfulness could be of benefit to society in such a way that it doesn't just help individuals cope and adapt to the toxic conditions that they're already having to work in.
Yeah, I don't know anybody who's doing that. I think that's nonsense.
In Silicon Valley, just down the road from Ron Purser's home, mindfulness is all the rage. And while some call it the new caffeine, and others see mindfulness as little more than a fashionable way to network among the technorati, Jon Kabat-Zinn works with the tech world to take mindfulness further.
MBSR has been at Google for 8 or 9 years. The people who are teaching it are wonderful. The humans that are taking it, they're humans first. They're not just Google people. They're human beings. They suffer. They work. They have problems. They have families. They're benefiting from this. Who's to say that it shouldn't be done? Should Google take more responsibility and all of those companies, whether it's, you know, Facebook or Microsoft, for the effects that they're having in their communities? Absolutely. But how do we influence those people? We work with them. We work with their CEOs. We're not bought by them. We don't need them. They need us more than we need them. And I tell you, a lot of those people are in their 20s, 30s. They're billionaires. And they want to change the world. They have good motivation, but they don't know exactly how. And they also want to invent the next thing. So why shouldn't mindfulness be a part of that if that's what they want?
I think joy underlies the entire Buddhist practice. The right question to ask should be, how do I front load the joy? I know some people went to college, they did Greek studies. I did geek studies, so close enough.
I'm talking to Chade Meng Tun, the guy who brought mindfulness to Silicon Valley.
Some people have accused me of that, but I'm not sure.
Where he created the Search Inside Yourself course for his colleagues at Google.
To create a high-resolution perception into the process of emotion.
Search Inside Yourself and the leadership course it spawned are now global brands. And Meng's left the tech company to do more meditating in his shrine room.
This over here is a tanka painted by His Holiness the Karmapa himself over here.
That is very beautiful.
He's also busy engineering new versions of old Buddhist business models to see if turning a profit can be done more wisely and compassionately by a mindful corporation.
Traditionally, it's been considered that the teachings are too precious to charge for. The teacher offering the teachings freely and the student giving according to their ability.
I do feel that the way it is going to work is for monks, not monks, practitioners who are doing this practicing full time to serve in the real world in the way that provides economic value. And in return, they get a livelihood so they can practice. I'm trying an experiment. I'm starting something which we jokingly call the Zencubator.
The Zencubator?
Yes. So the idea is to co-locate a Zen monastery with a tech incubator in the same compound.
So that plays off the word incubator that's often used in tech companies.
That's right. So a tech incubator is when you fund a group of small companies, small startups, there are two guys in a garage. But instead of a garage, they come to your center. And then you just help them grow their companies. So what if when they're doing that, they're also right next to or in the same compound as a Zen monastery where the monks practicing full time? So the monks every day, maybe one of the monks will come and do some teaching. And then so as part of the condition for being funded, the founders, maybe half an hour a day, they have to go to their site to do some sitting. So I call them the Nirvana site and the Nirvana site. So what if Nirvana and Nirvana interact? The first effect, I hope, is that companies get wisdom and compassion in their DNA from day one. So when they graduate and when they become Google, they have wisdom and compassion from day one. I'm hoping also founders who have those mental and emotional skills more likely to be successful. So as an investor, we make more money. And more importantly, to fund the practice, to fund the monks who are sitting there. So the monks, they provide economic service and in return, they get funding to eat so they can do their practice. So this is one model I have in mind, which I'm pursuing right now.
Meng's latest book is called Joy on Demand. Back at IMS, Stephen Batchelor is the most famous teacher known for rethinking the Dharma for a secular age. And he's not alone in thinking that no matter which door to mindfulness you come through, ethics will grow.
You see, I think what happens is that a certain percentage of people who use mindfulness, let's say in healthcare, discover quite quickly that to be mindful of their thoughts or feelings or whatever is also opening up a perspective on life that is not reducible to dealing with the anxiety problem, but actually affects everything about who they are, what they are. It allows for many people the first real experience of an inner stillness and calm and presence in which they're able to discover a whole new perspective on what it means to be human. Inevitably, that raises ethical questions, questions such as, what is this life for? How should I live? These are ethical questions, and I think they arise almost naturally, I would say, when the mind becomes more still and open and clear and less judgmental, which is another mindfulness term used in all contexts, to be non-judgmental. That's a highly charged idea, to basically suggest that mindfulness takes you to a place in yourself when you're no longer determined by your conditioning, your fixed views, your religious beliefs. It opens up a space. And that space is often a space in which the deeper questions of your life are able to come forth. And a certain percentage of people who have that experience will then Google mindfulness, find out that it's a Buddhist meditation practice, and end up going on a Buddhist retreat.
The retreat's called Integrated Awakening. The format of the retreat is began at 5 in the morning. We have an early morning meditation session, then practice of sitting and walking meditation finishes about 9:30. People have a lot of exhaustion. In this society, people override their body to get things done, juggling 10,000 things, all the download of information that happens. We get caught up in all sorts of narratives about ourselves and about the world, and all of that kind of rolls on, but sometimes we're not really in touch with the reality. So we begin very simply by breaking that kind of momentum of the mind, by encouraging the attention to be with a slower rhythm of the body.
Like other teachers at the Insight Meditation Society, social activist and former Buddhist nun, Tanisara, practices in the Theravada tradition. That's one of the three major styles that evolved as Buddhism spread out of India throughout Asia, both transforming and being transformed by each society it encountered over the last 2,500 years. But Tanisara's latest book, Time to Stand Up, An Engaged Buddhist Manifesto for Our Earth, represents what some are calling a newer fourth type, engaged Buddhism.
You know, there is a critique that it's the whole new age, mindful meditation world, it's very white, it's very entitled, it's very middle class, it's very comfortable. And there needs to be a challenge to that, really. This practice isn't just about ourselves at this point, it's about actually how do we bring this into the world and how do we decolonize ourselves and the structures and systems that we've been shaped within for centuries that are actually contributing to this decimation of nature and marginalized peoples. I know many, many of my dear friends in the Dharma that are working in extraordinary situations, prisons, schools, Parliament in England, friends, both Palestinians, Israelis, working to bring some of this practice into that conflict.
The current of the flowing river does not cease, and yet the water is not the same water as before. So goes a famous expression of the Buddhist concept of impermanence, written by a Japanese monk in the 13th century. And as the ancient Buddhist practice of mindfulness meets the West, how will they each change? I like what Zhou Enlai famously said when he was asked about the impact of the French Revolution on Western civilization. Legend has it, the Chinese premier paused and then replied, "The impact of the French Revolution on Western civilization? It's too early to say."
That's the thing with awareness. You can't open that Pandora's box and try and control what's going to happen, Because once you open that, you're actually inviting consciousness, the intelligence of awareness and consciousness, to start to come into play. And we don't know where that will go. So I have a lot of hope in that, you know, that you might think you're just doing an 8-week stress reduction retreat. We might be actually seeding a revolution at the same time. I hope so.
Who Owns Mindfulness was produced by me, Sherry DeLeese. Sound engineering by Russell Stapleton. The executive producer was Claudia Taranto.